Hi, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. The U.S. relationship with Russia dominates the headlines as the president of the United States seems determined to recast America's place in the world, as does a Russian president groomed during the Cold War. As the Bard famously wrote, the past is prologue. For insight into Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, we might want to look at Tsar Nicholas II and President Woodrow Wilson a century ago when the geopolitical balance of power changed dramatically. Russia expert and author Will England joins me to talk about his new book, March 1917, On the Brink of War and Revolution. We'll look back at the tumultuous events that shaped the world 100 years ago this month and examine their resonance in the current state of U.S.-Russian relations. Midday gets underway after these headlines. And thank you, Andy, and thanks again to everybody who has pledged so far in this spring membership campaign. You're listening to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We are grateful to everybody who's gotten involved so far. If you haven't made that call, why don't you go ahead and make it as soon as possible? 410-235-1395 is where you call to make a pledge. As I said, you're listening to Midday. Russia remains firmly in the news, and that's our topic today. 17 American intelligence agencies have determined that the Kremlin attempted to influence voters during the presidential campaign by spreading disinformation and hacking emails of Clinton campaign officials and senior leadership of the Democratic National Committee. One senior U.S. official, General Michael Flynn, was forced to resign for not being forthright about his contacts with the Russian ambassador. And another, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, is facing calls to resign for doing essentially the same thing. America's posture towards Russia has ebbed and flowed through two world wars and the Cold War to the optimism of the perestroika during the Brezhnev-Gorbachev years. Relations deteriorated significantly during the Obama administration, especially when Russian aggression in Crimea and Ukraine led to international sanctions. President Donald Trump appears to think highly of Russian President Vladimir Putin, but skeptics think that Trump's bromance with Putin is premised in naivete rather than a studied understanding of geopolitics. As Will England points out in his new book, it's nothing new that an American president may not understand Russia and may be ill-equipped to predict what Russian intentions are on the world stage. England is an editor at the Washington Post Foreign Desk. He oversees the paper's Russia coverage. A Pulitzer Prize winner, he has had three tours as a Moscow correspondent for both the Washington Post and the Baltimore Sun. His book is called March 1917, On the Brink of War and Revolution. Will England joins me on the line from the newsroom of the Washington Post. Will, good afternoon. Thanks for your time.
Hi, Tom. It's my pleasure.
So why March 1917? Why is that particular month so crucial for our understanding of what happened 100 years ago and perhaps even for our understanding of what's going on now?
Well, in 1917, World War I was raging in Europe, and the United States had stayed out of the war. Wilson, President Wilson, was determined not to get involved, and he won re-election in 1916 on the slogan, "He kept us out of war." But events developed, transpired, and Wilson, on the American side, began to worry, really, that Europe was destroying itself, and, nothing good could come out of that. And on the other side, the Germans began feeling that they had to make a dramatic move in order to blockade England and try to win victory in the war. So Wilson, and just to back up a little bit here, Wilson in January of 1917 made a speech at the Senate. He called for peace without victory. He said America would broker a honest peace among all the warring powers and would help to build a better world out of this. Wilson had told his cabinet that he was afraid that the European war would destroy white civilization, is how he put it, and it was America's duty to preserve white civilization. The Germans answered his call by renewing unrestricted submarine warfare in the North Atlantic. It was a real slap in his face. January, February went by. there were some ships that were sunk. There were no casualties. Wilson hated this whole sort of submarine issue. Of course, a lot of people were saying, oh, America has been insulted, offended. Our honor depends on our joining the war now. Wilson didn't want to do it. But in March, the pressure grew, and a long way of saying, at the same time in Russia, you had the sudden outbreak of protests that led to revolution. A revolution had been predicted by many, but no one knew when it would come or how it would come. It began with protests over the scarcity of bread in the streets of Petrograd, which is today St. Petersburg. And within a week, the Tsar had abdicated. And this is the kind of the main argument of my book. Americans immediately seized upon the new government that took power, a sort of a liberal faction within the powerless, up to that point, powerless parliament, and said, these guys are Democrats. And by God, democracy is on the march around the world. And if we're going to have a hand in promoting democracy and building democracy, we need to get into this fight too, shoulder to shoulder with the Russians, the French, the English, and we'll defeat German autocracy and we'll build a far better world out of it. It was a really quite dramatic misunderstanding of what was happening in Russia.
And
it put us into the war.
Yeah, and of course there was vehement opposition to being involved in the war. In World War I, there was continued opposition to being involved in World War II even. But in World War I, a lot of camps, two different camps, the ones who thought we should be involved, others who preferred a more isolationist policy, which of course had been the policy of the United States government for some 140 years or so. But Wilson does say that the world must be made safe for democracy. You mentioned that this provisional government that came to power when Nicholas II abdicated was seen initially as Democrats. And you say that the fact that there was a revolution, the fact that the Tsar abdicated the throne, giving up centuries of royal rule, that was the thing that opened the door for U.S. involvement. What's exactly the relationship, the causality between Nicholas II abdicating and the United States entering the First World War?
Well, from the moment the war broke out, there were people who saw it as a battle between democracy and, you know, autocracy, particularly German autocracy. Theodore Roosevelt was certainly in that camp, and he was advocating for a long time for military preparedness and for getting into the war. But there was a big problem with that argument because you had the English and the French allied against Germany, but also the Russians were on the same side as the English and French. And Russia, to Americans, was almost like a shorthand word for the worst possible despotic government you could imagine. The one Russian word that most of us know today is vodka. The one Russian word that Americans knew 100 years ago was pogrom, you know, which comes from the
treatment of the Jews.
Russian attacks on Jewish settlements, right, and mostly in Ukraine and Belarus. Russia was just felt to be an intolerable autocracy, an intolerable nation. And so how could you make this a war for democracy if one of your allies was the Tsar, Nicholas II? It just, you know, it didn't compute. Now, I want to be clear that the German submarine warfare had an awful lot toward pushing the U.S. in the direction of war. But Wilson hated that issue. It was sort of tawdry. It was commercial. You know, it was a handful of clapped-out old freighters. He didn't think it would – there was anything ennobling about it as a cause for war. And then comes, you know, the argument I was making that, oh, wait a minute, Russia has become a democracy. Overnight, Russia is a democracy. We can make this war about something more profound, more honorable than it had been up to this point. It's no longer just grubby empires fighting each other in the mud in Europe. This is about a war to build a new world. And that's what he wanted to do.
And in terms of parallels to contemporary events, you make the point that in 1991, 2 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, President Reagan famously calling on President Gorbachev of Russia, you know, tear down this wall. So the wall comes down, and you say in 1991, we made basically the same mistake we had made in 1917, thinking that the provisional government that followed the Tsar was in fact democratic.
It was the same category of a mistake, yes. I was there as a correspondent for the Baltimore Sun back in those days. It's hard to believe it was 26 years ago. And there was a tremendous hopefulness in the United States that Russia was now joining the community of nations and that we would help them foster democracy. Wilson had sent a commission to Russia in the summer of 1917 after the U.S. entered the war, helping the idea being let's help them foster democracy and also give them the material assistance that they might need and the expertise that they might need. And the Russians were really tried their best to be polite about this. But, you know, it was like this, they didn't need American kibitzing at this point. And the same exact thing happened in 1992 and 93. And it gave rise in some ways to the hostility that current President Vladimir Putin, you know, exhibits toward the United States.
And when it comes to that animosity between the United States and Russia. Here we have Mr. Trump repeating a claim that he's made ever since he was elected when he addressed Congress about a week ago. He said, I don't represent the world. I represent the United States of America. So he seems to be going back, turning back years of American foreign policy, becoming much more nationalistic, isolationist than we've ever been before, because you make the point that after we did commit to being involved in World War I, we came out of World War I as the undisputed world power. There are a lot of things that were a surprise about World War I. One of them, in your book, you talk about how it surprised everybody that in just a course of about 18 months, not very long at all, we were able to mobilize millions of men to go fight in Europe. So when Trump returns to this isolationism that was in place when Wilson was elected in 1916, I don't know, is there evidence to say that Trump has it right?
Well, I guess history will let us know. Obviously, as you know, the United States tried to return to an isolationist position in the 1920s and into the 1930s. But the country had, because of World War I, the country really had been thrust into a leadership role in the world, and the world wasn't going to leave it alone, as December 7th, 1941, you know, was to prove. There's never been a strong isolationist impulse since then, I would argue. And you're right, this all began exactly 100 years ago with Woodrow Wilson saying, you know, we need to make the world safe for democracy. He put democracy, self-determination, which is kind of the same thing, and human rights at the forefront of American policy. Now, you know, was there some insincerity involved? Was there some cynicism? Yeah, certainly. And there's been a great deal of all of those in the century since then. But it's still been the a rather powerful call to action for Americans is the promotion of a better world outside our borders. And it's difficult for me to believe that that century has just come to an abrupt close, but that would seem to be what President Trump is looking for.
Will England directs the Russia coverage for The Washington Post. He was a Moscow correspondent for The Post and The Baltimore Sun. His new book is called March 1917, On the Brink of War and Revolution. By the way, Will England will be talking about his book a week from tomorrow at the Ivy Bookshop in North Baltimore and a month from today, April 6th, at the Johns Hopkins Barnes & Noble Bookstore in Charles Village right here in Charm City. We'll have more with Will England after a break. Thanks to everybody who has made a pledge of support to WIPR in this, our spring membership campaign. If you have yet to make a pledge, now is a great time to do just that. Let's send it back to Andy Bienstock, who can tell you just how easy it is to become a member. And thanks, Andy. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, it's another installment of Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. We're going to talk about public funding of the arts. The Trump administration has signaled that their budget priorities lean heavily towards increases in the Defense Department at the expense of budgets for the State Department, the EPA, and other programs, including the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which, as you may know, funds part of the budget here at WIPR. So we're going to talk about all that with Sherry Parks. We'll talk about what it might mean for Maryland and for the country. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Will England, the author of a compelling new book about the Russian Revolution, which places that cataclysmic event in the context of the oppression of African Americans in Jim Crow America, the struggle for suffrage among American women, and widespread unrest in the American labor movement. The geopolitical balances that changed 100 years ago still indelibly inform the relations between Russia, the United States, and the rest of the world. Will England's book is called March 1917, On the Brink of War and Revolution. Our phone number here on Midday is different than the number that you're calling to make a pledge in our membership campaign. That number, the pledge number, 410-235-1395, our number to talk about Russia and the revolution and the current state of affairs between our two countries, is 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. If you want to drop us a tweet, that's good too. Our handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Will England, thanks for your patience while we talk a little bit about pledging in our membership campaign. I am really fascinated in the parallels that you draw between what was going on in Russia and what was going on in the United States, and how this involvement in the First World War dramatically affected things here at home, particularly for African Americans and for women and the labor movement. What are the general themes that you draw out between those three constituencies and how they were affected by Wilson's decision to enter the First World War?
Yeah, it was a it was a tumultuous time in the United States, partly because of the war going on in Europe. There was a tremendous economic boom in the first 2 years of the war, and a lot of people in this country felt that it wasn't being shared fairly. And I came across one letter complaining about the 2%. Now, today we say the 1%, but they said 2% in those days, who were getting all the benefits of the economic boom, and the rest of us were slaves. Women had been pushing hard for the vote for quite a long time. You had African Americans organizing. The very beginnings of the Great Migration to the North, spurred in some part by the war, by the increase in factory jobs, and also the ending of immigration from Europe because of the war. Labor movement was really in a state of unrest. There were strikes all over the place as people wanted to get their share of the money that was coming in. So as the U.S. was approaching the war, each of those groups, the women advocating for suffrage, African Americans, labor unions, were faced with the same question. Do we come out in support of the president and the government if he should take us into war, in order not to lose ground on our own particular issue? And there were tremendous deep arguments on both sides in all three of those constituencies. I found it particularly interesting among African Americans. You had people who believed that if African Americans stepped up, enlisted, could organize what they then called colored regiments, and prove themselves on the field of battle, that they would, the white society would be forced to give African Americans a place at the table when the war was over. There were W.E.B. Du Bois, one of the founders of the NAACP, was in this camp. There were others who said, well, wait a minute, you know, we're not so eager to be targets for German bullets. Let's get a little, let's get some civil rights here in this country. Let's stop lynching. Let's improve the lot of people here before we worry about going overseas. Well, the first camp kind of won in a sense. There were some very storied black regiments, particularly the Harlem Hellfighters, who served in France. And yet, at the end of the war, in many ways, the situation got even worse for African Americans than it had been before the war. Lynchings were up. The Ku Klux Klan thrived. There was a lot of white reaction, fear, insecurity in the face of black movement to the North and the black prowess that they had shown on the battlefield.
And it's interesting that the some of the deprivations that were happening in Russia were also happening here in the United States. I mean, you talked about bread lines in Petrograd, which is now St. Petersburg. But you also talk about bread lines that were very much in force in New York City. There were problems with the economy before we went into the war. And immigration, of course, which is very much in the news today. I mean, the president has reissued an executive order about immigration just within the last couple of hours. You write that in 1910, one in seven Americans were born abroad. And in 1914, we had 1.2 million immigrants. So the American culture in 1917, when we got involved in the war, was a very different thing than it had been previously. When it comes to immigration, how did that affect the body politic and the political discourse? I was fascinated by your observation that there was a school here in Baltimore, Baltimore School Number 1, which had a socialist club in 1917, the year we entered the war. And that was not considered radical by any means. I mean, socialism, communism, these were viable and respected political theories at the time.
Yes, yes, they were not overwhelmingly popular, but certainly legitimate. You'd had a socialist running for president in 1912, Eugene Debs, who got, I think, 900,000 votes, if I remember, across the country. And this public school number one in South Baltimore, the socialist club, most of the young people in it, I think they were all boys, were the children of immigrants. There was the immigration factor is just totally fascinating here, because you had German immigrants who tended to have come over much earlier. You're often talking about the children or grandchildren of German immigrants, but they had held on to a really vibrant German culture. And they were very much unhappy about the idea of going to war against Germany. H.L. Mencken, you know, fits into this group very much. And you had, of course, Irish immigrants, the second largest group of immigrants in U.S. history, I think. And this is all occurring less than a year after the Dublin Rising, the Easter Rising in Dublin. And so there was a tremendous amount of antipathy toward Great Britain. And a lot of Irish did not want to go fight shoulder to shoulder with the Brits. The Russian immigrants, who I mentioned briefly before, mostly from Ukraine and Belarus, most of them Jewish, also had no interest in a war that would put the United States in alliance with the Tsar of Russia and his anti-Semitic government. So this was a real pressure, real issue for those who thought the U.S. should enter the war to try to deal with. Now, what happened, of course, was that there was this anti-German hysteria, and an awful lot of Germans, as the war progressed, anglicized their names, the German associations folded, German newspapers went out of business. Baltimore renamed German Street downtown and called it Redwood Street after the first Baltimore officer to be killed in the war. The Irish, you know, the angry hotheads who had sort of been getting the attention when it was still an argument, you know, truly disappeared, and a lot of Irish immigrants served with a considerable amount of valor. In the war, there was the famous 69th Regiment in New York, which was an Irish regiment. My great uncle was the son of Irish immigrants from Philadelphia, and he was on the Western Front and suffered in a German gas attack. So that resistance crumbled right away. And then with the Russian immigrants, of course, you have the Russian Revolution. Suddenly, Russia doesn't seem like such a bad country anymore.
We have some calls and emails that we will do our best to get to after a break. Will England of the Washington Post is my guest today on Midday. His new book is called March 1917, On the Brink of War and revolution. On Mondays here on Midday, we read the names of those people who are victims of homicide in Baltimore. Five people lost their lives to violence in our city last week. They are Deron Strickland, age 35, Anthony Griffin, age 26, Gerald Long, age 79, a man who has yet to be identified by police. He was 30 years old, and Richard Cotton. He was 40 years old. So far this year, 55 people have been killed in Baltimore, according to the Baltimore Sun and a researcher named Ellen Worthing, who has been keeping a list of homicide victims for the past 15 years. We're also indebted to Edward Erickson of the City Paper for his reporting. You're listening to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll take a little break and come back for more with Will England on Russia, past and present. But first, we want to take a few minutes to talk about how easy it is to become a member of WYPR. It's our spring membership campaign. Becoming a member is easy, and it's important. Here's Andy Beanstock to tell you more. And welcome back to Midday. Thank you, Andy. I'm Tom Hall, and thanks to everybody who has made a pledge so far in our spring membership campaign, and thanks to all of you for listening. Russia is front and center on the minds of Congress and the intelligence community. My guest today is a guy who has spent a lot of time in Russia. Will England was a Moscow correspondent on three different occasions for both the Baltimore Sun and the Washington Post. He now directs the Russia coverage for the Post, and he's just published a new book about the fall of Tsar Nicholas II and how the Russian Revolution changed the political tenor, not just in Russia, but in the United States and around the world. The book is called March 1917, On the Brink of War and Revolution. You can join our conversation with Will England. Again, it's a different number than the number you call to make a pledge. The pledge number, 410-235-1395. The midday number to be part of our conversation, 410-662-8780. 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org. If you want to drop us a tweet, our handle is @MiddayTomHall. Will England, let's go to the phones here. Daniel from Baltimore, welcome to the program with Will England.
Hello?
Hi, Daniel. You're on the air. What's on your mind today?
I might have a strange anecdote from a book that was written about 1957, after the 40th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution, and I think it was Alan Moorhead, but I can't remember exactly. But an interesting anecdote about the sort of attitude that might have caused so much resentment among the Russian population, especially the army, the peasant army, was the I read that the Tsar's officers would require the lower enlisted people, if asked questions, they, instead of saying, "I don't know," to some officer, they were required to say, "I cannot know, Gospodin, or my lord." And I think it was that sort of attitude. And then coupled with the total incompetence and failure of the Tsar's army against the Germans, that was one of the major things of the outbreak in March, the total collapse then.
Well, thank you for the call, Daniel. Will England, in your book, you make the point that there were actually two Russian revolutions, one known as the February Revolution because simply the calendar they were using was different than the one we were using here in the United States, the Julian as opposed to the Gregorian calendar. But after this provisional government was put in place, another uprising led to what became the Soviet Union. And a big reason for that, you write, is that the authorities in Russia at the time wanted to make sure that they didn't have any more of these ground-up uprisings that they couldn't control.
That's right. That's right. The Bolsheviks who carried out the second one always referred to it as the Great October Revolution. I think it's probably be more accurate to call it a coup d'etat. They seized power with very little real opposition. But the lesson that they drew from the February Revolution, there's an interesting little anecdote in my book. The communists, the Bolshevik leaders who happened to be at large in Petrograd in March, most, of course, were in exile or in prison. Those who were still at large met the evening of the first and second nights of the protests, determined that there was not going to be a revolution and that it would be a historical mistake to take part in it. So they didn't. They had no role whatsoever in the first February Revolution. And the lesson that they drew was that street uprisings, and over the course of days, you had hundreds of thousands, perhaps even millions of people in Petrograd taking to the streets, battling with the police. The key moment was when the army started disintegrating and the soldiers came over to the people's side, and then you had the police and the soldiers fighting each other. What the Bolsheviks took from that is the most dangerous thing that the authorities can face is a revolt from below, an uprising on the streets. And they were determined, after they took power 7 months later, that that was never going to happen with them. And, you know, for a very, very long time, it did not. And that informs President Putin's attitude towards street protests in Moscow today. You know, it's a very unwelcome reminder of the power of people if they apply themselves. And he has been determined, not only in Moscow, but in Kiev and in Syria and in Libya, not to let popular revolutions get out of hand, get and take control.
You write about how various constituencies were just dead wrong about what World War I could accomplish. It did not make the world safe for democracy. It did not dismantle Germany's military establishments, as Teddy Roosevelt and others thought it would. And Teddy Roosevelt was very much pro-war. He was ready to jump into battle himself and lead a brigade. It did not improve the standing of African Americans, as many African Americans here in this country thought it would. And even Leon Trotsky, who begins your book, Living in New York, thought it would transform the sort of notion of a world revolution, and that didn't happen. So almost everybody was wrong about Russia. We have an email from Frank, and it's inevitable that somebody would bring up the Twitter storm from the president yesterday morning or Saturday morning. And I wonder, you know, if we made so many mistakes back in 1917, do you see us making these same mistakes again? And Frank writes that there is a pattern to the tweets from the president. You can be certain that one of three things is happening. Either he's trying to deflect or reframe the issue or distract from the issue. These are intended to time out the news cycle. The media plays into his hands by making his tweets the focus of the news, and meanwhile his Russia connections are wallowing in the darkness. He says that things we don't pay attention to are more easily swept under the rug. Tweets distract us from the real news. You handle and oversee the Russia coverage for a major paper of record, the Washington Post. What do you make of these tweets? What do you make of people's understanding at this juncture of the relationship between Russia and perhaps people involved in the Trump administration, or at least in the Trump campaign?
Well, this is, I think, a very good point, that what Trump was doing looks very much like an attempt to change the subject. And I think it would be wrong for the press, the media, not to report these tweets. You can't just ignore them. I don't think, however, that they're causing people to lose sight of the Russia story. It may have been Trump's intention, but the Russia story is so troubling and so apparently so extensive that I'm very sure that my paper and other news organizations are going to continue to be looking after it. What we saw when Michael Flynn, the National Security Council advisor, resigned, and now with these accusations against Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, they seem to be covering up something that it is not in itself a crime. I mean, talking to the Russian ambassador is a normal thing for people in the government of the United States to do. So it suggests very strongly that they're, people at least have raised this question, that they're, are they covering up something else that maybe is quite a bit less palatable than conversations with the Russian ambassador. So this is what everyone is trying to learn about. The parallels to 1917 are there in the very large sense, but not in the sense of anybody thinking that Woodrow Wilson was, or people in his administration were colluding with the Russians or the Germans or anyone like that. This is a different kind of a scandal than I think I can recall this country ever having.
The former director of the National Security Council, James Clapper, has said that there were no wiretaps in Trump Tower. Spokesman for President Obama said there were no wiretaps in Trump Tower. The head of the FBI, James Comey, has urged the Justice Department to say that there were no wiretaps in Trump Tower. But there was an article in your newspaper on Saturday by one of your national security correspondents who says that perhaps it was possible that people were surveilling some of these Russian diplomats, these Russian operatives, and in the course of that surveillance ended up surveilling some contact and some phone calls between those people and people who were in Trump Tower or who were associated with the Trump campaign. Can you tell us anything about that? I mean, no, I haven't seen anybody else adducing that as a possibility, but is that possible?
Oh, I think it is, yes. I think it's very evident from what we've learned so far that the telephonic conversations of the ambassador and I'm sure other Russian officials are often listened into, eavesdropped on, by American security people. And if, in fact, there were regular contacts between the Russian embassy and Trump Tower, these might very well have gotten picked up by our security agencies. Does this mean tapping Trump Tower? No, it is different. It's a distinction with a difference.
Will England is a foreign assignments editor at the Washington Post and the author of a terrific book that becomes available officially tomorrow. It's called March 1917, On the Brink of War and Revolution. Will, thank you so much for your time. I know you're busy on a day like today, so we'll let you get back to the newsroom at the Post and break a leg with the book. It's a terrific read.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
By the way, Will England will be talking about his book a week from tomorrow at the Ivy Bookshop in North Baltimore, and then on April 6th at the Johns Hopkins Barnes & Noble Bookstore in Charles Village. Come to WIPR.org/midday, and we've got more information. Thanks to The Diz for supplying lunch for Midday on Mondays. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekend. They're on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. That'll do it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, we'll examine the proposal that the Trump administration is considering to eliminate the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Dr. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland joins me for this month's installment of Culture Connections. I hope you can join us tomorrow for Midday. I hope you'll also become a member of WIPR in this, our spring membership campaign. Thanks to everybody who has made a pledge so far. If you haven't made a pledge, this is the perfect time to do it. Andy Bienstock is here with the very simple details.